From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. As the House impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump moves forward this weekend, it was full court press by Democrats and Republicans to shape the public's perception of this critical moment. For example, when President Trump told the Ukrainian president, quote, "I would like you to do us a favor, though," did that constitute a presidential abuse of power? Well, yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said no.
I have zero problems with this phone call. There is no quid pro quo here, but I do have a problem with Nancy Pelosi.
Well, on the same day and over on ABC's This Week, here's what House Intelligence Committee Chair Democrat Adam Schiff said about the exact same call.
It is illegal, improper, a violation of oath, a violation of his duty to defend our elections and our Constitution for the president to merely ask for foreign interference in our election.
Well, this hour on Point, we'll look forward to next steps in the impeachment inquiry, and we'll also look back to lessons for Congress and the American people from impeachment attempts in the past. And you can give us a call with your question or your response to these questions. What do you make of Democrats saying they're taking a careful, respectful approach to this inquiry, or the GOP's insistence that the impeachment push doesn't have any legitimate ground to stand on? Are there lessons from history here? Or does today's hyperpartisan environment mean we're in new territory when it comes to the process around impeaching a president? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll start today in Washington with Philip Rucker. He's the Washington Post's White House bureau chief, and he's reported extensively on President Trump. His latest story for The Washington Post looks at the president's current state of mind around the impeachment inquiry against him. Philip Rucker, welcome to On Point.
Hi, glad to be here.
So first of all, tell us, I mean, there was obviously a lot of attention placed on members of Congress and their public statements this weekend. But how has the president been processing or reacting to the impeachment inquiry as it moves forward?
Not well. If you look at the president's sort of public musings on Twitter, he has been clearly agitated by this threat to his presidency. All weekend, he has been pushing out, his views on this, which is that it's another witch hunt, in his words, that it's an unfair persecution by the Democrats, that the media are somehow corrupt and in on this. And you know, his state of mind at this point seems to be that he is a victim here, a singular victim, a victim unlike any president in history, and has sort of concocted this almost warped reality where he acted honorably and has been hardworking as president, and yet is being harassed by Democrats who are trying to undo the 2016 election, and aided by the intelligence community perpetrating a hoax. Of course, the facts present a different reality, but that offers a window, I think, into the president's state of mind.
His state of mind, even as very key members of the Republican Party have been providing him with a very full-throated defense for the past week or so. I mean, for example, here's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina again. He told CBS's Face the Nation just this weekend on Sunday that he advised the president to, quote, keep fighting back against the impeachment inquiry. He told Margaret Brennan that he has no problems again with that phone call that the president made to the Ukrainian president.
I think this whole thing is a sham. I can't believe we're talking about impeaching the president based on an accusation, based on hearsay. Who is this whistleblower? What bias do they have? Why did they pick this whistleblower to tell a hearsay story? The transcript does not match the complaint. What's going on here? Why did they change the rules about a whistleblower? You can use hearsay when you could not just weeks before the complaint. So I think this thing stinks.
That's Senator Lindsey Graham on CBS's Face the Nation just yesterday. Philip Rucker, tell us a little bit more then about how you see the GOP shaping its defense of the president over the past couple of days.
Well, there are a couple of things that are interesting to point out here. Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham, has been among the most forceful, vociferous defenders of the president. But the defenses from some other Republicans have been notably muted to some degree. My colleagues on Capitol Hill last week were trying to talk to Republican senators. They're important because if the House ends up voting to impeach the president, it would be up to the Senate to conduct that trial and to vote whether to convict the president and effectively remove him from office. And a number of Republican senators shied away from even engaging the topic, said, you know, look, we're going to be jurors in an impeachment trial. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves and prejudge this. We need to see the information come out. Senator Mitt Romney, of course, has said he's been deeply troubled by the allegations and by what is shown in the transcript of that phone call between President Trump and the Ukrainian President Zelensky. And so there seems to be a little bit more caution, more broadly speaking, among the Republicans in the Senate than is represented by Senator Graham.
Well, Philip Rucker, stand by for just a moment, because let's turn now to Senator James Lankford. He's a Republican from Oklahoma. He's joining us today from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Senator Lankford, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be with you today. Thank you.
So, first of all, Senator Lankford, let me ask you, if this is still a big if, but if the House votes to impeach President Trump, it moves then to the Senate. Would you support, or do you believe the Senate should hold a full trial?
Sure, we should. You know, that's a constitutional responsibility to be able to go through the process. So there's no exception on that. Now, what the House passes and what they send over to us, we can look at it for its validity, try to be able to make an evaluation. But absolutely, there should be a response from the Senate if the House does an impeachment.
Mm. So then, obviously, that is to come, or maybe to come. Senator Lankford, then what do you think about the current allegations as we know them against the president? Do you think this impeachment inquiry has legitimate ground to stand on?
So that's the difficulty here. If we started at the beginning of this year, there were 100 Democrats in the House saying we want to be able to impeach the president, and they're working on convincing their peers to be able to do that. Early last week, 200 Democrats came out and said we want to do an impeachment inquiry on the president, and we're going to base that on information we'll get tomorrow. And it was a very odd week last week that literally 200 Democrats announced before they had any information about the whistleblower, before they knew the validity of it, before they had seen the transcript, before they had read the whistleblower report even, announced they wanted to open an impeachment inquiry about what they hoped they would read the next day. And then, of course, the information comes out the next day, and they said, see, we told you so, there'd be something there. So it made for a very odd political week that they literally announced the impeachment inquiry first and then actually read information to try to figure out why second. That puts a very severe taint on this whole process to show just how political it really is. Now, the challenge is then to be able to get the facts out of it, because everyone's so twisted around about the issue of an impeachment inquiry. And one of the main facts that everyone seems to be missing is the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, is actually the one who brought the issue up about Rudy Giuliani and about the Hunter Biden topic up to President Trump first. And then President Trump actually responded back to him. This has been big news in Ukraine for months and months and months. It's only now reaching the United States.
So, Senator Lankford, though, do you have a concern with the president's private lawyer, though, essentially conducting what some see as a shadow foreign policy on behalf of the president of the United States?
So part of the challenge is not a shadow foreign policy. It is doing political work for the president as well as legal work. Obviously, Rudy Giuliani has been very engaged trying to defend the president on all these accusations with Russia that now Democrats seem to have dropped. All of that, after 2.5 years, they've dropped the issue about Russia and Russian collusion, but there are still some things to be tied up there, including some connections in Ukraine, to try to figure out where this information was coming from. That's why there is a special counsel that's already been assigned by William Barr to be able to go do the investigation. That's John Durham, and his investigation's been ongoing, very quiet, as it should be, but that's been ongoing for a while. And then the next question is, you know, what has been done in the past and what is that? So Rudy Giuliani does have a responsibility to working for the president personally, but also in his political operation as well.
But, Senator, if I may ask, I mean, the political work that you're saying that Rudy Giuliani is doing on behalf of the president is, in effect, asking the Ukrainian government to launch an inquiry that could have an impact on a candidate running for president here in the United States. So it would have an impact. It's asking a foreign government to take up action that would have an impact on a U.S. election. Is that not a problem?
Well, it is a problem if it wasn't already an investigation ongoing there. Like, again, this has been big news for a long time in Ukraine to be able to study what happened, what did the previous Ukrainian government do, what did individuals do, what did their prosecutor do. There's been a transition in governments there in Ukraine over the summer, and so when that occurred, the new administration is looking at a lot of things the old administration already did. So, again, this is why Ukrainian President Zelensky brought this topic up to President Trump, because this is something they're already in the process of doing.
So, Senator Langford, it sounds as if, given what you just said, that if an impeachment vote is held in the House and moves to the Senate, what would be your bar to prove that that the president may have done something that's unbecoming of the office of the presidency of the United States?
Well, ultimately, if you're going to make a statement, if it's unbecoming the office of the president, that is a political statement to make. And obviously the House can choose to make whatever political statements, as I mentioned before.
But if I may, impeachment is a political process. It is actually separate.
That's correct. Yeah. It is actually a political process. You're exactly right on that. But that's why I say that 100 Democrats began this year saying we want to be able to impeach the president. And they've been working to find a moment to be able to convince their peers to join them in that. Now, apparently, last week, they convinced their colleagues, come join us in this, and let's go impeach the president. I think it's a very intense conversation when you're actually talking about high crimes and misdemeanors, when you're going through that process. As we learned as a nation a century ago, the impeachment of a president is not just about, I don't like his political views, I don't like how he handles himself. It is a criminal probe more than anything else. That's what the American people, I think, expect. I think the American people expect if someone is elected, the other side's going to work with them, that it's not going to become a distraction based on I don't like his political perspective or I don't like the way he handles himself. They want to know there's something bigger than that.
Well, Senator James Langford, Republican from Oklahoma, speaking to us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Senator Langford, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to visit with you today.
And Philip Rucker, White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Stand by for just a moment. We've got to take a quick break. We are talking about next steps in the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. We'll also talk to a pair of some of America's best historians on what history has in terms of lessons for us today. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about next steps in the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. And we'll also look back at lessons from history for this moment as well. I'm joined today by Philip Rucker. He's the White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, and he's with us from Washington. Philip, before we move forward into a little history here, I just wanted to get your take on what you heard Senator James Langford tell us before the break about his view on what kind of bar the House would need to clear in order to present the Senate with information regarding the trial that the Senate might hold on impeachment. He seemed to not really be willing to answer that question and sort of rooted this once again in terms of seeing this as a hyper-partisan political moment.
I think that's right. I think Senator Langford, like many of his colleagues in the Senate, is trying to withhold a judgment at this point and see how the facts develop and what ends up happening in the House. He's correct, of course, as you noted, that it's a political process in the House. But there's one point that he was making in going after the Democrats in the House that I think is worth clarifying.
Yes, please.
And that's their decision last week for more than 200 of them to go forward with calling for impeachment before seeing the transcript. He's right that they made that call before seeing the transcript of the phone call. But we should keep in mind that over the days before they made that decision about impeachment, President Trump himself was admitting in media interviews and public appearances that he had, in fact, asked the Ukrainian president on that phone call to investigate the Biden. So in that sense, Trump was acknowledging his own alleged wrongdoing in the phone call before anybody had to see the transcript. And that is one of the things that motivated the Democratic House members.
Indeed. And I appreciate that clarification here. So, Philip, stand by for just a second. I just want to play a little bit of tape from Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, who Senator Lankford also mentioned a couple of minutes ago. Mr. Giuliani, the former New York mayor, has been all over the media in the past few days. Here he is on ABC News This Week with George Stephanopoulos just yesterday.
If this were Donald Trump and Donald Trump Jr., I wouldn't be having to do this.
Mr. Mayor,
I am defending my client the best way I know how. This is not about getting Joe Biden in trouble. This is about proving that Donald Trump was framed by the Democrats.
If these charges are so serious and so credible, why have they not been picked up by the president's handpicked FBI director, the president's handpicked Attorney General William Barr?
I don't know if they have been or they haven't.
Rudy Giuliani on ABC News on Sunday. Well, joining us now from Nashville, Tennessee, is John Meacham. He's a presidential historian and author of The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels, which takes a look at moments of crisis such as impeachment. He's also the winner of the Pulitzer Prize as well. John Meacham, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Also with us from New Haven, Connecticut, is Beverly Gage, professor of history and American studies at Yale. Her courses focus on American politics, political thought, social movements, and governance. She's author of a number of books, including The Day Wall Street Exploded. And she's currently at work on a biography of former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Beverly Gage, welcome to you.
Thanks, Meghna.
So let me start with this question. And Beverly, I'll just start with you. To my mind, this is the first time an impeachment inquiry into a president of the United States has focused on the president's interactions with a foreign government. Is that distinctly different from where we were in the past in impeachment inquiries of the past?
I think that's true in a technical sense. Okay. When we look at past impeachments or attempts at impeachment, of which there have been really three, those have mostly concerned kind of domestic offenses in the formal sense. That's what's been being investigated. But they've always also occurred in the context of a much bigger political story. And I think what isn't unique about this is that, as with impeachments in the past, the particular charges that have come up really reflect a bigger political narrative about the president. In Bill Clinton's case, there was already a pretty well-established narrative about his sex life, about his deception. In Nixon's case, there was already a pretty well-established narrative about Nixon and dirty tricks. In Andrew Johnson's case, he already had opposition to his views on Reconstruction. So the technicalities, I think you're right, are different, but they feed a narrative that I think in certain ways looks quite familiar.
And John Meacham, your response to that same question.
I think that's true. Impeachments have unfolded at moments where we confronted, as a country, divisive existential questions, right? Andrew Johnson was attempting to undo the verdict of the Civil War. He was a compromise candidate to become vice president as Lincoln ran for a second term in 1864. He was really a Democrat and was put on the ticket with the first Republican president to secure some border states. He then, after Ford's Theater, becomes a retrograde force, someone who was attempting to secure white supremacy despite the verdict of Appomattox. And in fact, the Republicans began trying to impeach him as early as the December of 1865. It took a couple more years. In Nixon's case, you had, in a moment we tend to forget, but half century ago, people thought we were engaged in a second civil war. The divisiveness over Vietnam, the questions about ongoing white backlash against segregation, the changing nature of American identity. You'd had the Stonewall riots. You had the women's movement. You had people believing that the country was changing in fundamental ways. Huh, that sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? And what happened in Nixon's case, which I do think is the most interesting analogy, is you actually had evidence. You had tapes. You had transcripts of tapes. You had documents that charted how the president of the United States had attempted to use law enforcement, national security, the national security apparatus of the country to preserve his political position when he was attempting to spy on opponents. Again, there's a lot. Mark Twain once said, history may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And I think that's the rhyme here.
Yeah. Well, Philip Rucker, you're our modern day connection here to what's happening right now in Washington. And I'm just looking back again at the story that you had in the Post a couple of days ago about the president seeing himself currently as almost as a unique historical figure, right? That the president tweeted last week, there has been no president in the history of our country who has been treated as badly as I have. But that sentiment has always been, as you pointed out in your story, Philip, that sentiment of victimization has always been kind of at the center of how the president sees himself and communicates his position to the world, hasn't it?
That's exactly right. And this feeling of persecution and self-pity predates Trump's time as a politician. He had these feelings and shared them as a real estate promoter when he was on reality TV. But in a political sense, it's been the glue that connects him to the grievance politics of the political right in our country. And, you know, when you talk to Trump's grassroots supporters at these MAGA rallies, as I have over the last few years, they will say that they feel uniquely protective of this particular president because they feel like he, just like them, has been oppressed and been ostracized by the elites. And so what Trump is doing strategically right now is to cast himself as a victim, cast himself as somebody being persecuted in order to galvanize his supporters behind him and maintain his political strength as he stares down impeachment.
Mm. Well, Beverly Gage, the president may see himself as uniquely victimized by history here, but given your lens as a historian, do you think that the evidence or the materials presented thus far that have triggered the House's move towards a full impeachment inquiry, is it legitimate ground to stand on?
I certainly don't think Trump is a victim in this case because, of course, victimization would imply that he himself has done nothing to either, in terms of concrete acts, create this situation or in terms of fomenting the level of divisiveness that he sees around him. So I certainly wouldn't characterize Trump as the great victim here. I do think it's one of the things that he shares with Nixon and one of the pieces of Watergate that really does work as a historical parallel. You know, Nixon was deeply sure that there was a conspiracy of the liberal media and the deep state that was out to get him. Mm-hmm. He was sure of that for a long time, well before impeachment proceedings began. And that sense of victimization, interestingly, I think continued after Watergate and after he had actually left office and, in fact, became itself part of the grievance politics of the Republican Party for a generation.
Well, John Meacham, I mean, we see exactly that even in, for example, the GOP talking points that were accidentally emailed to Democratic members of Congress here a couple of days ago. The first talking point is press reports have given currency to flat out falsehoods about the call, that call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. And we have heard White House advisors talking about deep state conspiracy, even just in the past couple of days.
Well, they're tapping into an ancient American tradition defined and delineated best, I think, by Richard Hofstadter, who was a Columbia historian who wrote a very important essay called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. It goes all the way back to the 18th century, to the beginning of the Republic. There are periodic moments in American life where a conspiracy theory becomes a defining narrative. And Hofstadter popularized the phrase in October 1964 with a cover story in Harper's Magazine that was about how the power of the paranoid style was to convince a passionate group of true believers that there were unseen forces attempting to take away their power and compromise their standing and their identity. The context for that essay in 1964, obviously, was the John Birch Society. It was the Cold War paranoia that somehow or another the Democratic Party, Dean Acheson, even George Marshall, was seen as a agent of the communist conspiracy. The Army Chief of Staff in the Second World War and the formative Secretary of State of the post-war order was under attack from the McCarthy era through the 1960s because the Cold War hawks needed, to some extent, a domestic boogeyman. They needed someone to organize their opposition to. And what President Trump is doing here is drawn straight from that narrative. You don't have to go very far here because Roy Cohn was part of it in the McCarthy era. This has a lot to do, as Beverly says, with the Nixon drama of believing that there were forces that were attempting to undo what true Americans wanted. The irony, of course, in Richard Nixon's case is here's a man who was a member of the House, a United States senator, vice president for 8 years, and the presidential nominee of his party 3 times. If he's not part of the deep state, who is? But he saw this as a defining drama, and that's exactly what Trump sees, is that, in fact, there are these people who are trying to undo the verdict of the 2016 election. The problem with the narrative is, as John Adams pointed out, facts are stubborn things. There's a large cloud over the 2016 election because of the question about foreign interference and the fact that we are now having this conversation about the president's attempt to, in a way, reignite the possibilities and the perils in many cases of a foreign government interfering with our sovereign elections for his benefit. There is a through line here. And I think that we have to be absolutely insistent on is that let the facts speak for themselves. Walter Lippmann said, and this is not a new thing, this idea that the supporters of a particular president decide and then interpret the facts. Walter Lippmann wrote an essay, a book really called Public Opinion in 1921, so 100 years ago. He said that one of the perils of the modern era was that people did not see and then define. Mm-hmm. They defined and then they saw.
Right. Right. John, Beverly, and Philip, stand by for just a second because I do want to let some callers in here. Let's go to David, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. David, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that what Lindsey Graham and the rest are omitting in their rhetoric is that, first off, the aid that was approved by Congress was withheld, then the phone call. But more importantly, I think what shows, criminal intent and obvious admission of guilt is when the White House scrambled to get that phone call off of the normal server onto a highly secured server. They knew that that Trump had broken the law. And so why else would you take it off of the server if there's nothing to do? You know, if it's a perfect phone call, why would you not leave it where it is? And if I could just add, as an Oklahoman, for Senator Lankford to get out there and twist and spin, you know, he ran as a deficit hawk and as a moral voice and then voted for the 1%, adding $1 trillion to the deficit, and has just become a talking point spin doctor. So his credibility is zero in my mind.
Well, David, thank you so much for your call. Philip Rucker, did you want to respond to what David was saying about putting those communications on that separate, very secure server?
Yeah. Listen, he raises a really important point there, and he's exactly right in that the White House staff, people on the National Security Council, did in fact move the notes from that call with Zelensky onto a more secure server, which is one usually reserved for much more sensitive material. There was not anything of a particular classified or rather highly sensitive nature with this phone call with Zelensky. Nonetheless, it was moved there in large part to keep people from inside the government from being able to easily access it. According to our reporting, that has been done with other calls, including with Russian President Vladimir Putin and with the Saudi Arabian royal family, and is an unusual step to be taken inside the White House.
Huh, interesting. Beverly Gage, we have about a minute before we have to take a quick break here, but I want to loop back to the approach or the behavior of President Nixon versus President Trump. Because I think that's, I mean, in fact, to what Philip was just saying, that is there's not really this dividing line, it seems, regarding President Trump between what he thinks is, you know, best for, you know, himself versus what's in the national interest. Was that, did Nixon have that same blurring of lines?
Well, Nixon was certainly a self-interested politician, and of course, what got him in trouble was his re-election campaign. But he was also someone with political experience and had real political ideas, and I think is a little bit different from Trump in that sense.
Okay, well, I want to explore that more with you when we come back from just a moment. I'm joined today by Beverly Gage. She's professor of history and American studies at Yale. John Meacham also joins us. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian. And Philip Rucker is with us. He's White House bureau chief for The Washington Post. And we're talking about next steps in the impeachment inquiry and also the lessons from history as well. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about next steps in the impeachment inquiry and also lessons from history as well. I'm joined today by Philip Rucker. He's White House bureau chief for The Washington Post. John Meacham joins us. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian. And Beverly Gage is with us as well. She's professor of history and American studies at Yale, currently working on a forthcoming biography of former FBI director J. Edgar Hoover. Well, let's listen to a little bit more about what has been said over the past couple of days by both Republicans and Democrats regarding the House moving forward with an impeachment inquiry. Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on CBS's 60 Minutes on Sunday night defending the president against the impeachment inquiry. He told Scott Pelley that the president has done nothing in that phone call with the Ukrainian president that constitutes an impeachable offense.
How do you expect the president's defense to roll out going forward?
The defense of what?
Well, there's an impeachment inquiry.
Yeah. There's an impeachment inquiry going forward. It probably never would move forward had the speaker waited 48 hours to have the transcript. We vote on important things every day, but there are certain votes that are different than others. Sending men and women off to war is the most difficult vote any member of Congress would ever make.
I'll ask you again. How does the defense of the president, in your view, roll out from here?
Why would we move forward with impeachment? There's not something that you have to defend here.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on 60 Minutes last night. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was at the Texas Tribune Festival over the weekend, and here's what she said.
But this is, again, about the oath of office. It's not about
right.
politics.
Yeah.
It's not about partisanship. It's about patriotism for our country. And so, again, I have handled this with great care, with great moderation, with great attention to what we knew was a fact or what was an allegation.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at the Texas Tribune Festival over the weekend. Beverly Gage, What do you make so far of how the parties have been talking about this in the past couple of days? I mean, for example, specifically what Nancy Pelosi just said. We've been hearing Democrats say this a lot in the past 48 hours about handling this moment with great care and with moderation.
Well, you said earlier, Meghna, that this is a political process, and that's absolutely true. It's has some legal aspects to it, et cetera, but this is fundamentally about politics. And part of what politics is about creating an effective narrative. And I do think that that's going to be one of the really interesting things to watch going forward. I mean, impeachment and the process itself, if we look at history, produces all sorts of surprises. So if there had not been an impeachment inquiry, a set of congressional inquiries underway in the Nixon case, we never would have even known that Nixon had the White House tapes that became so crucial. Those came out in the process of the hearings. So there's an inherent unpredictability in this whole process. But we are already seeing these very concerted attempts to shape the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think at the moment we're seeing them in a sort of short-term sense. What is this going to mean for next week? What maybe is it going to mean for 2020. I think the historical examples suggest that it's also worth thinking about what kind of long-term examples we're going to have, because in some ways, you know, while Watergate was certainly a disaster for the Republican Party in 1974 and one might argue in 1976 as well, they fully recovered by 1980, had Ronald Reagan in the White House. And that was partly because one of the narratives that came out of Watergate was that Washington was corrupt, politics were corrupt, and it actually paved the way for an anti-government conservative to come into the White House. So these narratives really matter. They're going to change, but they're going to be really important.
John Meacham, are we in sort of uncharted territory, though, regarding the party's differing powers to shape that narrative, as Beverly is talking about? Because unlike during Watergate, we have, you know, a not just a hyper-partisan political environment, but we have a completely different media environment as well. I mean, I suppose one might only imagine what President Nixon would have done if there were Twitter in his time. I mean, is it a meaningful difference?
I think it is a meaningful difference, and I think the we might as well just call it by what it is. The Fox News Channel and their opinion broadcasters are leading a charge and have been doing so over the past 3 years, no matter what – 4 years now – no matter what the issue is, saying that their side is right, the other side is wrong, and it is a constant drumbeat. And if you have, I suspect, like all of you all, I spend time every week watching differing networks just to check in and see which planet one might be on, depending on where you land on your television. Mm-hmm. I think it is important. Now, it is also true that there has been a partisan press in this country from the very beginning, but it is because of the bifurcated world, and because of the constancy of the power of broadcast, I do think that the Democrats will have a harder time because of the existence of the media climate today. What I would argue to Republicans is, where do you want to be when history is told? And you know, we talk about Joe McCarthy, and it's not a good thing. And the person we remember from that era is Margaret Chase Smith, the senator mm-hmm. from Maine, who mm-hmm. stood up in 1950 and said, this is wrong. And then it took the men 4 years to catch up with Senator Smith. The political calculation on these things is very hard to make. If we had been here today – in late September of 1974, and I had said, you know what's going to happen? There's going to be a very close presidential election in 1976, but the Democrats will win, and then they're going to lose three of the next presidential elections. And the next time a Democrat wins, and in fact the only Democrats who won until Barack Obama were white Southern governors who ran to the center, you would have thought I was crazy. So it's just not possible, it seems to me, to guess what the political impact of this will be down the road. One other point.
Wait, actually, John, can I just jump in?
Yeah.
Because you asked a really important question there about that you would ask Republican members of Congress.
Yeah.
Like, how do they want to be viewed by history? I mean, given everything that you just said, wouldn't a plausible response be, well, we have no problem with how history might view us because, you know, as Beverly pointed out, the long-term narrative is one that might turn to their advantage.
I don't think there's any scenario in which the age of Donald Trump turns to anyone's advantage, honestly. And that's not a partisan point. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I voted for both. I live in Tennessee. So when I say I have conservative friends, I'm being redundant. But there's not a scenario where the behavior of this president, the more vivid and damaging attempts he has made at bringing the constitutional norms that have served us extremely well for nearly 2.5 centuries, nobody is going to come out of this. Has anyone come out of this looking better because of their association with this president?
I suppose what I meant is political advantage versus sort of moral and historical advantage. But John, hang on for a second, because I do feel an obligation to let at least a couple more of our callers in. And Beverly and Philip, I'll come back to you as well. But let's go to Mike, who's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a liberal Democrat. I think that Trump is probably one of the worst things that has happened to the United States. Yet I'm against impeachment, and I'm against the impeachment process because I think it's yet another example of Democrats who have to be shown to be in the right at the expense of being effective.
Mike, I'm going to take it back from there because your phone's really hard to hear. But Philip Rucker, Mike from Salem, Massachusetts, basically saying that he's a liberal Democrat but opposed to impeachment because he fears that it actually could actually backfire for Democrats in 2020. That is still a pretty significant concern amongst Democrats, is it not?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And what Mike just said, I think, gives voice to one of the main reasons why Speaker Pelosi has been so slow to get to this point in launching impeachment. You know, many members of her caucus, the Democratic caucus in the House, supported impeachment months ago over the president's alleged obstruction of justice in the Russia investigation. And yet Pelosi resisted beginning formal impeachment proceedings in part because she feared this political backlash. The Ukraine call is what pushed the caucus over the edge to move forward here. But, you know, Pelosi's a political tactician and she understands the moods in these districts. And I think I know she and, you know, many of her more vulnerable Democratic members are paying very close attention to the sentiment back home and making sure that they're not seen as overreaching or speeding too far ahead or trying to take advantage of the president in some unfair way.
Well, Beverly Gage, you run the program of Grand Strategy. About grand strategy at Yale. I know you've been asked about this before, but how do you see Speaker Pelosi's strategic moves here? Is she following a smart path?
It seems that most of what she has really been measuring, and rightly so, it makes sense for her position, is the amount of political support, both within her own party and in the American population at large, for moving forward on impeachment. Now, it should be no surprise that that's her primary calculation. I think it is worth noting that I think one of her concerns seems to be what the consequences are going to be, not for Trump, not for the Republican Party, not even for the 2020 election, but within the Democratic Party itself. In what ways is this going to interfere with other things that the Democrats might want to do? In what ways is it going to create divisions within the Democratic Party? Now, the party seems pretty united right now, but that's certainly got to be one of her concerns. And I would say, in terms of thinking about strategy, I suspect that she's doing this, but we shall see. It's important to think also in different timescales. So there's tomorrow, there's a few months from now, there's the 2020 elections, and then there's the long term. And you actually need to be thinking about all of those things at once in the context of a rapidly changing situation that is inherently unpredictable. Now, I think there's no magic formula for doing that, but I do hope that certainly Pelosi and the Democrats as a whole are having those kinds of systematic conversations.
Yeah. I also wanted to hear from you, Beverly, what you think of what John was saying a couple of minutes ago about this fundamental question that he would ask Republican members of Congress about how they wish to be viewed by history as the nation moves forward. And he mentioned Margaret Chase and her speech from 1950, Senator Margaret Chase from Maine, I should say. And I've just pulled up a little bit of it here. In her speech, she says, "Mr. President, I would like to speak briefly and simply about a serious national condition. The United States Senate has long enjoyed worldwide respect as the greatest deliberative body, but recently that deliberative character has been debased to a form of hate and character assassination." That was the beginning of a 15-minute address she gave. And as John pointed out, several years before perhaps the rest of her party rallied around this notion. But do you see... I mean, Mitt Romney says he's got concerns. I don't see that same sort of ringing of conscience, public declaration of conscience happening here, at least in the GOP.
I do think that's right. The McCarthy example, though that was not a case of impeachment, of course, I do think is a fascinating one to think about because on the one hand, what finally brought McCarthy down, led to his censure, was that his own party turned against him. And there were people very early on making these ringing declarations. But it's also true that it took 4 years in McCarthy's case. And he was just a senator. And he was out there saying some pretty outrageous things. So the fact that this might just be a process that unfolds over time, I think, is something that we should assume that what people are saying right now isn't necessarily what they're going to be saying in a few months. And ultimately, you know, in the case of McCarthy, yes, it's absolutely true that the historical consensus is, you know, that McCarthy was a travesty for American democracy, for civil liberties. But it's also true that there was a surviving narrative, particularly on the right, that McCarthy himself had been a victim. And that fueled actually a lot of energy on the right going forth in the 1950s. So in some sense, you're always going to have competing historical narratives. But I think John's right that the judgment of history would certainly favor Margaret Chase Smith.
We've just got 2 minutes left in the show here. And John, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to Beverly, and then I want to close with Philip here. But John, what do you make of what Beverly said?
I agree. I think that McCarthy took 4 years to foreshorten the McCarthy era. It took 26 and a half months to remove Richard Nixon from office. It takes a long time. This is a big, complicated, disputatious, diverse country. And the one thing I would say about the Trump era that is unique is even the people who are defending him are defending something that in their hearts, insofar as one can tell the secrets of the heart, they know this is largely indefensible. I promise you with everything I've got, if the poll numbers for Republican senators, if they were looking at numbers in their states where the strongly support, not just the support, but the strongly support category of Republican voters in their states were not at 80% and 90%, if they were at 60%, we would be having an entirely different conversation. And so this is not about, to bring drag poor Edmund Burke into this, you know, Burke defined representation in two different ways. He said sometimes a representative owes you a reflection of your will, and sometimes a representative owes you his judgment. If they were going to offer their judgment, this man would be impeached and removed.
Mm. Well, it's interesting that Nixon is the first name to come to mind when we think of impeachment, but in this conversation we've heard about Joseph McCarthy as well, and I suddenly remember that Roy Cohn, who worked with McCarthy in the 1950s, was later Donald Trump's mentor for more than a dozen years. Philip Rucker, we've got 20 seconds left, so I'm afraid I'm just going to have to say that we're looking forward to your next story in the Washington Post today, because I'm sure
you've got
reporting to do.
Philip Rucker,
White House Bureau Chief for the Post, thank you. John Meacham, Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian, and Beverly Cage, Professor of History and American Studies at Yale, thank you all so very much for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.